Don't you know they're talking about a revolution? Sounds
it's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Keith, and here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, February 21st, 2013, and here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. Bill's going to look at a headline that says that the Fed fears a backlash from paying banks. He's got some interesting details there. I've got a report on gold being audited at the New York Fed. Everything's intact, and we'll laugh at that report because it's quite ridiculous. Bill's got an interesting piece from George Will. He's going to take a look at it. The piece is entitled Time to Break Up the Big Banks, not what you normally hear from a conservative. Got a piece from Elizabeth Warren, the new senator from Massachusetts, who's striking fear in the hearts of Wall Street. But we're also going to look at, she's striking at the wrong issue. I have a very disturbing article that we're going to talk about police giving advice to schools and staff members. If there is a shooter, attack him unarmed. Very disturbing. Bill's got a couple of interesting articles from Reason Magazine, one entitled 41 Billion Reasons Not to Sweat the Sequester and Don't Look to States to Torpedo the Obamacare Plan. That's the other one. But we're going to start off this hour looking at a relatively new issue, one that hasn't surfaced before. It's got a word in it that Bill absolutely loves. He was joking about it before the show. That word is zombie. We have zombie foreclosures. And what zombie foreclosures really amount to is that borrowers are getting hit with debts that won't go away and can never be resolved, which is a rather disturbing sequence of events. So we'll go there first. First of all, actually, before we go there, Bill, glad to have you back once again.
I don't know what the zombie sound effect is. You know, you have to do it's kind of a low growl or something.
For a zombie?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. We're going to talk zombie mortgages. How's that?
Okay.
Okay, all right. So now we can talk about zombie mortgages. Well, let me just read a little bit from one of the articles I found. There are actually a number of them out there on the web, but I'm taking this one from CNN.com. And you'll get the hint of it, the idea of it pretty quickly. Borrowers are discovering that their foreclosed homes are coming back to haunt them long after they had moved out. In these so-called zombie foreclosures, borrowers move out after their bank schedules a foreclosure auction only to learn months or years later that the auction never took place or the bank never transferred the deed. That means the borrower still technically owns the house and is on the hook for property taxes, fees, and homeowners association dues. Since the housing bubble burst 7 years ago, almost 2 million properties have started but never completed the foreclosure process, according to RealtyTrack. And while no one knows the exact number, it's estimated that tens of thousands could be zombie foreclosures. And just in time, an old buddy of us has joined us today, Bill G. Hey, he's joining us on the program today. And
hey, good to hear from you guys.
Bill has been through this kind of thing himself. So,
yes.
Bill, before we go any further, you gave me a statement to read if you couldn't make it, but you made it, so why don't you just tell us in your own words what your experience has been?
Well, what has happened to me is I'm kind of a living example of this this zombie foreclosure thing that's been going on. Basically, what happened was back in 2010 when I started I wanted to sell my house in Burlington City. We had a failed short sale, and then the next thing you know, we were going through foreclosure proceedings, and we had a deed in lieu, which is a deed in lieu in foreclosure. And they executed it. A short time later, I declared Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and I assumed at that point that I was on the road to recovery, financially anyway, and that was not the case. What had happened next was that they never foreclosed on my home. I just did a title search today at Realty Shark, and that title is still in my name. So technically, I am the property owner of this property in Burlington City. I am technically on the hook for the property taxes that the bank has been paying for the last 4 years, and the utility expenses, the water bill, and all that stuff. And so technically, the Citibank could sue me for $28,000. So the the stories in that article are true about those other people who were experiencing that. Another interesting aspect of it is the deed in lieu of foreclosure still is not shown up on my credit report. So it just doesn't exist.
So you're kind of in no man's land.
What was that?
You're kind of in no man's land.
Yes, I am way out in no man's land. And what's interesting about this is at the moment I have no credit. I have no credit cards. I don't have an auto loan. I don't have a mortgage. I'm living out of my parents' house, and I'm in the process of trying to put my life back together, but I'm scared to death of that day that I apply for an auto loan or I apply for a mortgage, and is this going to come back to haunt me? This zombie going to come back to haunt me? And based on the stories that I've read on the web today, it has been a nightmare for most people, and I'm pretty much done. Until this zombie foreclosure finally goes through, which will then start the clock on my ability to get a mortgage, because it'll usually typically takes about 4 years after a foreclosure before you can actually get another mortgage. The clock hasn't even started on me yet, and it's been 4 years.
And is there any indication when the clock will start?
No indication whatsoever. In fact, the Citigroup keeps calling me up and saying if I'd like to refinance or do a short sale on that house. The latest phone call was like 2 weeks ago.
Unfortuitously, I was in a similar predicament about a year ago, managed to get myself out of it. And since we're in the habit of bashing banks, in this case I'm going to come to the defense of banks because they're just following the law. What happens is that they can foreclose on a mortgage, which is one loan on the property, but they cannot sell the property until all of the other liens that are on the title are resolved. I had like three liens on my property. We were in default. We sold it in the market. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we weren't underwater, so I could settle all the liens that were outstanding. But until all those liens are settled, the property cannot be acquired. The title mm-hmm. of the property can't be acquired by the banks.
In my particular case, there was only one lien, and that was owned by the bank.
Oh, okay. Well, then there's... That's a different circumstance. You're sure there weren't any credit card liens on the title?
No.
Is it really a different circumstance, though? I question whether it's a different circumstance. Let me give you two reasons why. The first reason is that I don't think we can give the banks a little bit of a clean sweep. They're not guilty on this one. Because the banks, like any large corporation, is heavily involved through lobbying in the way these laws are formed. So if the laws are formed in such a way that they leave borrowers in this impossible situation, saying, well, it's not the bank's fault, is just ridiculous. The banks helped write the laws. Of course they wrote the laws in such a way that's not going to affect the banks if they can all help that. Their hands are clean on this is ridiculous.
In the article you're referring to, all the cases were situations where people had other liens besides the first mortgage. They had a second mortgage, or they had a credit card lien or an auto loan lien or whatever it might have been, that they weren't aware of or ignored.
Even if we accept that that's true, here's the question. What is the established procedure for making sure all this stuff clears out? And the answer is there isn't one. And I guarantee you that was perfectly okay with the bank lobbyists. They had no problem with that.
Well, that may be true. The established procedure is that the state or the county has a record of the title along with all of the legal liens, and it is your obligation as the owner to be aware of all those liens and settle all of them prior to selling the property. You have to do that. Now, foreclosure settled one of the liens, and in the case of Bill G., if you go through a bankruptcy proceeding, they have to do a title search to find out what obligations are outstanding, and they should be resolved by the bankruptcy. Now, if he wasn't aware of them or there was something that was overlooked by his bankruptcy attorney, that isn't really the fault of the bank, that he wasn't aware of it, or the bankruptcy proceedings weren't done properly, because the bankruptcy proceedings should have dissolved all of the liabilities. Now, again, every case is different, so I don't know.
But again, that points back to what I was saying. The fact is that the law was always written, and I knew about this 30 years ago. I was aware of this many, many years ago when I first bought a home that I kept for about 9 months and got rid of it for reasons we don't need to go into here. But the point is, I understood just talking to the title agent at that time, because I wanted to understand how the whole process worked. Just talking to him, I said, well, what would happen if a case kind of similar to what we're talking about here happened? He said, well, all hell would break loose. And I said, well, why would that happen? Why hasn't this ever been ironed out? And his answer was, because the powers that be have no interest in having a way for it to be ironed out. I thought that was a really interesting answer at the time. I didn't quite understand what he meant by it, but now I have a much better idea of it. If the banks can just simply not have to deal with that, then they can play all kinds of games to their own benefit. And that's what they're doing. That's what they're doing with these mortgages.
Exactly.
The reason they don't want to foreclose is because there is financial advantage to them in not foreclosing, even though they want to claim to have the right to foreclose on it. So they keep it in limbo.
Absolutely. And I can tell you exactly what they're doing with that. What they're doing is they're holding the loan balance. Now, the loan balance I owed on the house was $170,000. Now, the house is not worth $170,000. In fact, they'll be lucky to get $90,000 for it. So what they're doing is, by keeping that house in limbo, they can declare on their balance sheet that they have they can hold it at amortized cost, which is that loan balance, which is $170,000. If they actually go through with the foreclosure proceedings, then they have to declare that asset at market value. So that means they would have to write down that $170,000 by half. And they would have to do the same thing with the 10,000 other people that they are also doing that to with these zombie titles.
Yeah, I'm not disputing the fact that the banks are taking advantage of the law, but it's always been the law for centuries that you cannot sell something you don't own. You have to, resolve all of the existing claims on the property before you can sell it. And that's not something the banks put into the law. It's been there for centuries.
No, nobody's disputing that. The question isn't whether or not that's the way the law is structured. The question is, does the law provide a way to iron this stuff out when things go wrong? And the answer is it doesn't, and that it's deliberate, and that is a direct reflection of what the banks wanted in the first place, as they helped to frame that law over the centuries.
Well, I think part of the problem is that people are, accept the common term that they are the owners of a property when, in fact, they are not. They are partial owners of whatever liquid asset they have in the property. So a person may believe that they own their home, but, in fact, the bank owns the home, or the credit card lender owns the home, or there are a half dozen other things, and, of course, the first priority is the government's tax liens on the property, which always come first. So even if you had a small amount of property tax due that was not paid in the foreclosure, then that lien is on you personally against the property. So now the state of California or the feds own the property. They are as much an owner as you are, or the bank is. So I'll grant you that this is all a messy business, but the concept, I don't think it puts. Yes, banks take advantage of the laws, and they understand the laws better than the average Joe Blow, and to some degree, they probably intentionally avoid resolving the issues that a supposed owner ought to have resolved on his own. But there's a perfectly legitimate method of resolving those issues, and that is getting a copy of the title, which shows all the liens on the property for all the creditors, and negotiating with them to pay off the balance. I had to do that with three credit cards in the state of California on a past due tax amount. But until those are resolved, there isn't a clear title, and the bank can't sell it.
Well, that was my point. There was the title was clear with the exception of the mortgage. In my particular case, it was a clean title, with the exception of the mortgage, and it still didn't get resolved. And there's no mechanism that I've tried numerous mechanisms to try and get this thing resolved, and it just hasn't. It just sits there in limbo, and it's going to stay in limbo indefinitely until the bank gets around to actually cleaning this up.
Have you tried going to your county registrar and just filing a statement of ownership transfer to the bank?
No, I haven't tried that.
Because that's the county registrar is usually the one that keeps all the legal records that determine the status of any particular property.
And they need to read up a little bit on MERS.
How's that?
You need to read up a little bit on MERS.
On MERS?
MERS, yeah, that's the mortgage system that the bank set up that bypasses the county recorders.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that. Tell me.
Yeah, you better read up on that one.
Okay.
I mentioned that there were two reasons why I thought that the banks didn't deserve a free pass here, and I've already mentioned one of them, the fact that they helped over the years to write laws in such a way that situations like this couldn't be resolved without them being able to do whatever they want to do with it. But the second reason why I think that there's really very strong guilt on their part here is that it is in the interest not only of banks, but of corporations and politicians and power brokers of all kinds, to make law as complex as humanly possible. And the reason I point that out is because here we are trying to parse Bill G in terms of how he can try to resolve this issue that the legal system has set up, and we're assuming, or perhaps Bill, you're assuming, Bill Westmiller, you're assuming, that, well, there are ways to resolve this. I'd be willing to bet that the average person not only doesn't know that there are ways to resolve it, but doesn't even understand how property law is put together. In fact, I'll take it even a step further. I'd be willing to bet that most property law attorneys don't fully understand how it's put together. and I'm not saying that to disparage attorneys. I'm saying it to disparage the law and the way it has been structured for centuries. Because like you say, this has been going on for centuries. I say that it is a deliberate thing. The structuring of law to make it as complex as possible is done deliberately because it benefits those in power. Because the average
or it benefits the trial lawyers. Trial lawyers want as many laws as you can possibly have, as complex as they can possibly be, so no person can defend themselves against any kind of allegation.
Well, they're often one and the same because 90% of legislators are lawyers.
True.
So, no, I can't give banks a free pass on this. I can't give corporations of any kind a free pass on this, and I certainly can't give the government a free pass on this. I think there's a ton of guilt to go around here.
Yep. I agree.
Okay. Well, now that we beat that horse to death, time to go on to the Fed. We'll beat that one to death next. Bill Westmiller, you found a little interesting piece about
like a lot of other people out there. I don't understand enough about property law to, because when this deed in lieu was first going through, they were like, oh, it's easy peasy. You just, you sign these forms, and there was a gazillion forms to sign. And we transfer the title over, and we own the property. We'll manage the property, and then we'll liquidate it, and you never have to worry about anything ever again. And that's exactly what they told me.
Yeah.
And well, anybody that's who's bought a house has gone to a realtor's office or a title office and signed 10,000 sheets of paper.
Yeah. And how many of them read them?
Exactly. That's what I said to the gal who was doing it. I said, does anybody ever sit down and read through all of these things before they actually sign them? And she said, believe it or not, there's one out of 100 that actually sit here and read through every single document before they sign it.
Exactly.
And
right.
I said, hey, the bottom line is pay or die. that's what you're signing off.
But that's not true, is it? Apparently, it's more than pay or die. It's pay or die or be in perpetual limbo so that you can't continue to live even though you're still breathing.
I feel like for that one mistake I made of doing the deed in lieu or even buying the house in the first place back in 2002, I'm going to be paying for this for pretty much the rest of my life with these And it may not be the rest of my life. It might just be for the next 5 years or so, but it feels like the rest of my life because in the meantime, I can't buy another house. I'm afraid to even get a car loan because they're going to pull up credit history and they're going to see the bankruptcy, which will be, you know, that'll be gone in a couple of years. I'm not really worried about that, but they're going to pull up a title search on me and see that I'm technically the property owner of a property in New Jersey that I haven't paid any tax on and I haven't paid any mortgage on for the last 4 years.
Yeah. And that's extremely serious. I mean, what we're basically talking about here is you're one example of a whole population of people whose lives are so completely in limbo that they literally can't live. The tools of survival have been taken away.
There is a footnote to this, and that is the primary problem, I think, is a matter of communication. And actually, there was a federal law that was passed a couple of dozen years ago saying that the owners were obligated to inform the homeowner, the home occupier, of any change in the status of the title. And they don't do that. And there haven't been any prosecutions. I don't know if there's anybody actually even, you know, working on it, but there is an aspect of the law that is not being implemented.
Again, read up on MERS, M-E-R-S.
Okay.
You're going to get an education like you've never seen. just think corporate replacement of government recorder offices, and the banks basically get to keep all the records themselves, and you can't have access to them. That's MERS.
Huh. Is that a federal law?
No, MERS is a private corporation created by the banks.
Huh.
That's
considered proprietary information, so that way you can't get information with freedom of information or whatever.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So you have no right to the papers that directly impact your life, except that they're not papers, they're electronic.
I feel that way about my credit history.
Well, I mean, the whole housing bubble was a game in hiding actual assets, and it wouldn't surprise me if the realtors, in order to securitize mortgages, had to have this MERS system, so they could sell portions or interests in the mortgage.
Absolutely.
You
couldn't do it without it.
Yep.
Yeah.
You can't package it unless you have access to it.
Yeah.
I mean, among other things, you couldn't turn property as fast if you didn't have something like MERS.
Yes,
that's a big part of what happened with the housing boom.
Yeah, I agree. There ought to be a provision in a law requiring disclosure of transfer of assets that affect another owner.
Yeah. Yeah, they talk about property law being a mess. There's an example of it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree.
Well, speaking of messes, let's go on to the second story because we've gone one-third of the way through the show. We've got six stories left.
Okay.
We never finished the list, Walt.
I'm going to have to say goodbye at this point because I got to roll.
Oh, well, thanks for joining us for that story. I'm glad you were able to do that much.
Yeah, well, it was important, so I made a special effort.
You're going to be able to join us in the future, do you think, or is that still up in the air?
I will be able to join you in the future, but I need to settle in on my new location, which will be sometime in April.
Okay. All right. Well, then we'll look forward to seeing you then. Bill G.,
alrighty.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bill W.,
you
really want to get to this Fed article, honest to goodness. So the Fed fears backlash from paying banks. What's the backlash, and what are they not wanting to pay the banks?
Well, what has happened is ever since the big bailout back in 2008, the Fed and Treasury worked together to set requirements for bank margins, capital assets. And what the Fed did was they said, well, you know, we want banks to increase their backup backup assets on various risky loans and things like that. So we will take their money and we will put it on deposit and we will pay interest on the money that the banks, you know, have deposited with the Fed. And this is one reason why loans are so difficult to get is because banks can make more money with no risk putting it in the Fed and earning interest on that money rather than loaning out to consumers. The problem comes in is what one Fed director said is purely a matter of optics, and that is if they raise the interest rates because they see inflation is growing, that automatically raises the amount of interest they have to pay to all those banks. Well, that sums out to about $50 billion a year, which is a healthy chunk in comparison with what the Fed is spending to buy U.S. Treasuries and Fannie and Freddie mortgage interest. So it could be anywhere from $50 to $75 billion. Now, the fudge factor here is the Fed doesn't care. The Fed just prints up money so it can pay the banks in fiat currency that they create at the push of a button. But in terms of the fact that the Fed suddenly has to show an additional $50 billion in interest that it's paying out to the banks, looks bad for the Fed because on their bottom line they're even more in debt than they otherwise would appear to be. So it's an interesting conundrum for the Fed as to how to manipulate this interest they're owing to all the various community banks and so on in order to make them look good and make the local banks look good because they've got assets in escrow with the Fed.
So you describe it as an interesting conundrum. I would describe it as an absolutely bizarre conundrum. And the reason I say it's a bizarre conundrum is really quite simple. I mean, as you pointed out, the Fed basically creates money out of thin air. They're the Fed. They're the fiat money creators. So this whole notion that the Fed is in debt is just plain ludicrous. I mean, the whole idea of the Fed being in debt is an impossibility when the Fed can create money.
Exactly. Yeah.
And yet, for some bizarre reason, and I think I know what the bizarre reason is, vast numbers of top-level people in the financial community get all bent out of shape on this subject.
Yeah.
So why do they get bent out of shape on it? Well, I think there's one very primary reason. They don't want to give up on the idea of fiat money. The bizarreness of the conundrum is that this shows just how ridiculous the whole concept of fiat money is. It isn't just how bad the Fed is doing or what impact it's having on the economy. It's that fiat money itself makes absolutely no sense. And this shows that that wart, calling it a wart is kind of minuscule. It needs to be like, you know, this is the skin cancer.
So, well, I mean, it was something that they had to construct back in the 20s and 30s because basically they'd run out of money and so they had to eliminate the gold standard. And as soon as they did that, there was no actual physical valuable asset backing up any of the currency. And therefore, you know, who cares? Who cares that, you know, they just created out of thin air? It's just money. You know, it's just a medium of exchange. It doesn't have to have actual intrinsic value or represent intrinsic value. So let's just take the word reserve off of the $1 bill. It's now no longer a reserve note. It's not, you know, valuable in terms of redeeming it for gold or silver. It's just a piece of paper. And unfortunately, people, you know, as long as they can still use that dollar to buy what they want, don't understand that it has no value per se. The U.S. government just printed it up, and it's just a piece of paper, and that's all it is.
Well, it's actually even worse than that. I know it seems weird that there could actually be something worse, but there is actually something worse. The thing that's actually worse is that we talk about the ignorance of the population where property law is concerned. It's even worse where money is concerned.
Yeah.
And to illustrate just how ignorant the population are, this is a story I heard a number of years ago, but it's worth telling here. It's a story of a guy who wanted to teach people the nature of where money comes from. So he decided to engage in an experiment. He decided anytime he was going to go shopping, he was going to talk in a certain way, and you'll understand in a minute what that certain way is, and then see how people reacted to it. So to give you an example, he'd go into a drugstore, and you know he'd go pick something up off the shelf and take it up to the counter, and when he's at the counter, the person would be, you know, bringing up the stuff at the counter, and he'd say, oh, by the way, I want you to know I can only pay for this in Federal Reserve notes.
Ha!
And you know, the person behind the counter, of course, would be ignorant of what he's talking about. So she'd say, "Well, I'm sorry, we can only accept the real money." I said, "I'm sorry, I don't have any real money. All I have are Federal Reserve notes." And
she'd say, poor clerk.
"Well, we take a check." And he'd say, "Well, yeah, I can write you a check, but unfortunately, my check is also only drawn on Federal Reserve notes." So about this time, she'd get absolutely exasperated, saying, "Look, you know, I'm sorry, but we can't accept any other form of money. We have to accept, you know, real U.S. money." And he'd say, "Well, all I have are Federal Reserve notes." So she'd call over the manager, and the manager would come over and say, "What's the problem?" And he'd say, "Well, there's no real problem, except I just wanted to let her know that I can only pay for this in Federal Reserve notes." And so they'd go through the same game with him, and he'd get upset, too, often to the point where he'd call the police. The police would come in, and when the police officer would arrive, they'd go through the same routine again, and the police officer would hear the whole story directly from this guy, and the police officer didn't understand either. So he would threaten to arrest the guy for disturbing the peace if he didn't either pay or leave the merchandise behind in the shop. He said, "Well, I'm perfectly willing to pay. It's just that I can only pay in Federal Reserve notes."
That's cruel.
But it illustrates so perfectly that the average person has no clue what a Federal Reserve note is. You want people to understand that Federal Reserve notes are worthless? First thing you got to do is get them to understand what Federal Reserve notes are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, it's the government and bankers and financial people who do understand this can play all kinds of games with the currency, and they depend upon the fact that most people are ignorant of what they're doing, and not just ignorant in terms of not having the information available, but not having the slightest idea what money is, much less Federal Reserve notes.
So all
of the machinations that they do in the background have an effect on every consumer, every person that spends that dollar, that real money in their billfold, is going to see rising prices. They're going to see all kinds of economic effects on their income and on their assets and everything else. And they're not going to have the slightest idea how it happened. Because they don't have the knowledge to connect those rising prices to the fact that the government is printing more money. They just don't understand that.
Yeah. Well, we're halfway through. Let's take a break. And then after the break, we'll take one more shot at the banks before we start looking at some of the other issues that are out there, including that really horrible article that I found about what police are saying that people should do when they work in schools if the shooter enters the school. We'll get to that, and hopefully you won't throw up like I do when I read it. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walt Thiessen, Bill Westmiller. And before we go on to the next story, I just want to point out for those few listeners who might not know, if you're wondering what a Federal Reserve note is, take any bill out of your wallet, turn it to the front, and look at the top, and you'll find out what a Federal Reserve note is. Meanwhile, there are actually some interesting rumblings coming from the right regarding the idea of banks being too big to fail. And Bill, you're the one who dug this up. What did you find?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the standard sense is that it's a left wing and the progressive that are against banks and want to break them up. But George Will had an interesting column just last week or in this past week, saying basically that the big banks should be busted up, and he's saying conservatives will not be put asunder what the free market has joined together. A government nurtured all these behemoths by weaving an improvident safety net and by practicing crony capitalism. Dismantling the big banks would be a blow against government that has become too big not to fail. So although it's not something that's likely to happen, it's a little bit surprising that some of the Republicans and conservatives are beginning to recognize the corporatist policies that have been put in place for the benefit of banks and are maybe less reluctant about the idea of breaking them up, which is not an attack on the free market. It's an attack on a fixed market. So I thought it was rather interesting that George Will would chime in on busting up the big banks.
Yeah, it is interesting, and in fact, it's even a little bit encouraging. I just wish he would go a step further and recognize that the reason that these banks get so big in the first place is because there's a fiat money system, which George Will has long supported. But, you know, we'll take what we can get at this point, I guess.
True.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the aisle, there's been interesting and wonderful and fun illogic coming from the left as well, or logic, I guess, coming from the left, that once again covers some of the issue, but not all of it, this time from new Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, newly elected this past year. She basically ripped into regulators and starkly suggested that banks may be cooking the books. And, of course, her comments rippled throughout Wall Street and created a whole lot of bad backlash and so forth, and the Bankers Association issued statements. They said, we have been through more tests and thorough exams than any college student over the last 4 years, including many conducted by the CFPB. And there was a Wall Street executive who accused Warren of shameless grandstanding during the hearing. Of course, anyone who listens to this show knows that there is actually some truth to it. I mean, the nature of the way assets are valued these days, have to be valued these days, leads to a lot of room for accusing banks of cooking the books. In fact, it would be almost impossible for them to not cook the books just because of the nature of the way assets are calculated these days. So is it necessarily wrong to say that? No, it's not necessarily wrong. But once again, I'd have to say, I just wish Elizabeth Warren, like I wish George Will, would recognize that this system was created by fiat money in the first place, which she supports.
Yeah, well, Warren is as confused as a lot of other people are. I mean, her argument was that, well, you know, Wall Street banks are trading below their book value. And she's saying, I can only think of two reasons why this would be so. One would be because nobody believes that the bank's books are honest. Duh. Or the second would be that no one believes that the banks are really manageable. Well, they aren't, because the banks don't run banks. Government runs the banks. And it's the laws that make the bank's books dishonest, because the amount of money that they have on hand or in circulation is determined entirely by a government agency, which is the Fed. Now, it's a quasi-government agency because it's theoretically an association of all banks, private banks, but in fact, it is run under the auspices of the federal authority to create money. And that is what they do. And therefore, their books cannot be honest. They cannot possibly determine what the value of anything on their books is, because the value of their money changes every day.
And in fact, I have many times, I'm not sure if I've done this with you, Bill, but on this show many times in the past, I've pointed out that the system of banking itself is dishonest. And the basis for my point is the nature of fractional reserve banking. Because fractional reserve banking is essentially where you take depositors' money with or without their permission and invest it and earn rewards on that money. And then the reward, so to speak, that the depositor gets for their assets being at risk is they get a free checking account.
Yeah. If there are any right-wing listeners to the show, they'll recognize the name G. Edward Griffin.
Yeah.
Who was the one that wrote the book.
We had him on the show once.
Oh, okay. He's a great guy. But I asked him at one of his discussions about what the Fed was doing. I said, is fractional banking necessarily evil if it's honest? In other words, if somebody deposits their money in the bank and the bank tells them, we are going to take your money and we're going to loan it out, and it's a risky proposition, you may or may not get your money back, but we bought insurance to cover your deposit. And Ed said, no, if they were honest, if they were telling the truth about what happens to the money that goes into the bank, then there would be no problem with fractional reserves. The problem is that people think that they are depositing money in a secure location that is sitting there in a vault somewhere, that they can come back and get whenever they want. But that's not what the terms and conditions of the bank policies are. As soon as you open an account, you sign a piece of paper acknowledging that you know, the accounts are kept in Federal Reserve notes, and the bank has total discretion in terms of how they invest the money you deposit. And people don't read that, but they sign it when they open the account. Everybody does, and that's you know, that's the situation.
It's worse than that, though, because if you read, have you read any of those lately? Any of those contracts you sign when you open an account?
I never read them. I just know that they're got my ass in a knot. So
I've gotten a couple from local banks. I did this as an exercise in 2008 or 9, right after the financial crisis, just because I wanted to see what was there. The interesting thing is nowhere in those contracts does the depositor make any statement of permission to let the banks lend out the money.
I'll bet you that it's in there. I'll bet you that there's some fuzzy clause.
It really is.
I haven't read it, but I bet you there's a fuzzy clause in there that says...
there might be something written in legalese that is not plain, but there is no plain statement that says that.
Oh, no. No, there's no plain statement. I'll agree with that.
But
that's the
problem. To my understanding of what law is, or at least my limited understanding of it, law can only be considered law if it's understandable.
But that hasn't been true for the past 50 years, at least.
No, it hasn't been. That's a huge problem. But it should be. It should be understandable. Because if you can't understand the law, you can't obey it.
Yeah. No, that's kind of a truism that everybody would acknowledge, that a nation of laws is one where people can understand what the laws say and can deal with them. And that has, like I said, hasn't been the case for nearly a century.
That's right. Well, a lot longer than that, I would say. But yes, at least a century. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think we're basically in agreement. We're kind of slightly disagreeing on a fringe subject here, but I really disagree that there is any kind of honest fractional reserve banking. And I'll give you another reason, too. Even if you explain it, and even if you have it clearly written into the contract, I still claim that it's invalid. And the reason it's invalid is you have no option. The system, as it is structured, makes it possible for you to have only one way to participate in the modern economic system. And that is if you're willing to use a bank account that has this kind of provision in it. Well,
True. A
system of law that does not give you choices is not a system of law. It's a system of tyranny.
Yeah. Well, the only reason I say it could be done legitimately is that there are people who invest in banks. They give the bank $1 million or $10 million, whatever it is, and they are an investor in the bank, and so they have rights and privileges to know what the bank is doing with their money, and that's an investment. The victim is the small consumer who goes in and makes a deposit, doesn't realize that they are making an investment in the bank, and
yeah,
the bank is going to manage
their
money.
What's their alternative? Let's say they want to opt out.
There is
none.
There is none.
Well, then that's not. It's not. It's
I mean,
not
you
an
put your money in a mattress. It's still going to deflate.
That's really not an option. I understand that's what usually gets said, but that's not an option. You can't actively live in society that way.
As long as the government controls
either
the currency,
go along with craziness, go along with something that is morally reprehensible, or starve. Well, that makes the whole idea of fractional reserve banking untenable.
Well, like I say, if a person knows that they are investing in a bank and they have alternatives to banks, then I think fractional reserve is a legitimate proposition. It's the same as when you put $1 million into a company. You're taking a risk. You know you're taking a risk. You know that they're going to manage the money the best they can, but you might lose it all. People putting money in banks don't realize they're investing in a business.
I still don't buy it. Consider this. the way that banks operate is you make your deposit, they invest it, and in theory, you can withdraw at any time. Well, with a loan, if you're actually talking about somebody loaning money to the bank, an understanding of a loan is you don't get the money back until it's repaid.
Yeah.
So this is basically a fraudulent form of lending or borrowing, I guess you could say, because it's the bank that's doing the borrowing.
I don't dispute that. It's...
Yeah, so again, I say fractional reserve banking, there is no legitimate way to do it.
Well, only if a person is an investor, knows their investor, and has full rights to the information about what the bank is doing with their money. and a consumer doesn't have that.
And the bank can't make promises that are invalid, such as you can have the money back anytime you want.
No, you can't do that. An investment is always a risky proposition. You never, when you buy stock or anything like that, there's no guarantee that you're going to get your money back. You're probably going to lose it.
And that's a good part. I'm not talking fractional reserve banking anymore.
Yeah.
That's not fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking is all about you get your money back anytime you want to.
No, the fractional reserve says they ain't got the money.
Well, that's
invested
what
elsewhere.
Fumbled. But the theory that's presented by the fractional reservers is that the depositors get their money anytime they want it.
Yeah. Well, that's why they have the what you call it, a Band-Aid maybe, of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The guarantees you're going to get a certain amount back, but it's still not the full
amount. Let's never actually have a legitimate system. Let's take a bad system and put a Band-Aid on it so that we can pretend that it's actually legitimate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what it is. I agree.
It's insane.
What's next?
Good question. Well, we've bashed the left and then we bashed the right. Let's bash the police.
Okay.
This is actually very much worth bashing. This is an article that I found put out by, I'm not sure if it's a radio station or a TV station. I'm going to guess TV station, KSDK. And it's an article that talks about how police are now recommending that because of the frequency of shootings in schools, that staff and administrators be prepared to aggressively go after shooters when they come into the schools. Also applies to shopping malls and office buildings and that kind of thing. But with one little proviso, and by the way, their argument is, look at Flight 93 on the day of 9/11. The people fought back, even though they didn't have any weapons, they just fought back and almost took out the hijackers. The argument being that, well, you're in a situation of last resort, so you have to take action. But there's one proviso. They're against letting those teachers and staff members and office workers and students be armed. In other words, they should serve themselves up as human chum. They should go into the battle without weapons.
Yep.
And that is quite possibly the most morally reprehensible argument I've ever heard from a gun control advocate. The idea that paid government employees working for a school system should basically put themselves up as suicidal victims in order to try futilely to stop a shooter.
Well, not just teachers or administrators, but children.
Everybody.
The kid should just, tackle the guy and bring him down and take his gun.
Yeah, of course,
right.
Point bullets at you.
Well, it's good news in this sense. It's good news that the police are admitting that they do not have control and cannot prevent crime, period. And I think that's a good sign that slightly dissolves the edges of the authoritarian mindset that says that there has to be central control by government over everything, and individuals have to be banned from any kind of effective means of self-defense. I mean, if that's what you want to, propound, that the government is a solution to everything, then you can't, it's very difficult to admit that you can't fix it. You can't solve the problem. And that's effectively what the police association has done. They said, hey, we can't stop this. We can't prevent these things. Maybe we'll get there 30 minutes later to scrape up the dead bodies. But we can't do this. It isn't possible for us to be able to protect schools. So that it's good in that sense that they're not almighty. They're not the source of defense as a first resort. They are a last resort. When all else fails, then the police will come and they'll fix things.
Well, you certainly get high marks for finding the silver lining in the black cloud.
I'm a silver lining guy today.
that's a good thing. But I don't see how that in any way mitigates the fact that they are advocating that people serve themselves up as human chum.
Yeah.
That's just morally reprehensible in every sense of the word from any viewpoint. I don't care if you're pro-gun control, pro-Second Amendment. I don't care what your viewpoint is. That's morally reprehensible. And to have people like that in office, in control of keeping the peace, they should not only be fired, they should be thrown in prison for that. There should be a law against that, against authorities issuing statements that say that the civilian population has a moral obligation to surrender itself to death when someone goes nuts with a gun. That's
I'm not going to quote Ayn Rand, but that's the essential, you know, basis of the entire statist authoritarian ethic.
Is that
everybody, every citizen, has to sacrifice themselves for the benefit of the state.
Yeah, and that's really quite disgusting. So now that I'm thoroughly disgusted on that, let's go to something that's a little bit less disgusting. Just because we got to get the taste out of our mouths, you know. let's go to something that is disgusting, but it's humorously disgusting because we're so used to it. The budget crisis, the fiscal cliff that we're now falling off of, and you found a rather curious and interesting article on why we shouldn't be so upset about that. What'd you find?
Well, the sequester supposedly is a $1.2 trillion reduction in government spending. And, of course, everybody is screaming and yelling about how, you know, people are going to lose their jobs and the Defense Department is going to collapse into a huge pile and it's the end of the world and it's the stupidest way of cutting spending and so on and so forth. It turns out it isn't $1.2 billion. It's less than $1 billion in cuts over 10 years, which means that it's less than 1% of the budget. But the cuts are not from the current amount being spent, they are from the projected amount that they had planned on spending. So the effect of this is less than 1% of the budget is going to be sequestered. Now, if the government can't cut its budget by 1%, I mean, if we cut down this show by 1%, that would mean that there was 40 seconds of dead air, you know. So the whole thing is a preposterous scare game, as politicians are wont to engage in.
Oh, yeah.
To make people believe that the end of the world is coming unless they can spend all the money they planned on spending.
And that's pretty much what it sums up to.
Just a totally artificial game that they're playing, and there's a lot of, unfortunately, the thing that irritates me most is there are a lot of Republicans happy to play that game.
Apparently.
Well,
a few weeks ago that we reported how the Republican leadership was trying to basically block any of the new upstart Republicans who thought that government should actually be held accountable, so they kicked them off committee assignments and so forth.
The two Republicans who are always on the news shows and always talking about this issue are the two senators, John McCain and I can't think of his first name. Anyway, they're always on there saying, oh, this is the end of the Defense Department. If we don't, you know, allow the Defense Department to spend every dime that they have been authorized to spend over the next 10 years, it's going to be the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the deficit be damned, budget be damned, inflation be damned. We've got to spend this money, otherwise everything is going to fall apart. And, of course, Obama echoes what the Republicans say, and so they all agree. It's a bipartisan agreement. They got to spend the money because that's what government is supposed to do.
Yeah, that's probably the most terrifying idea of all. The Democrats and the Republicans agree there is no limit to the amount of spending.
Yep. Yeah, that's effectively what is in all of the little crises that they've had, the fiscal cliff and everything before that, you know, the debt limit and so on and so forth. Basically, it came down to a bipartisan agreement. Yep, let's keep the spending the way it is. Let's increase the debt. Let's increase taxes. Anything except to cut spending.
Except, of course, when the Republicans want to make it look to their base that they actually are opposed to all that. So they voice the opposal to it in the press, and then they go out and support it in the government.
Yeah.
Well, that pretty much sums that up. We have actually 1 minute left. We've got two articles. I realize that we skipped one. I'm going to do the one that we skipped because it's a fun one, and we need to end on a fun note after all this bad taste in our mouth. Apparently, the New York Fed was audited this week by the government. And the government reported that there is more gold, that all the gold is there, and that the gold is more pure than was originally thought. And to prove to future generations that the gold is all there and that it was purer than thought, even though that they only measured a tiny, tiny piece of the gold that's there, so they don't really know how much is there. They put a seal on it, and the seal is therefore proof that all the gold is there. I thought that was just a wonderful, heartwarming article for anyone who is an absolute dunce.
Well, there are a couple of amusing sidelights to this, and one is that this audit was done as a consequence of a bill that Ron Paul proposed to audit the Fed, and one of the things was to just count the gold and tell how much is actually there. Nobody, either the Fed or this audit committee, came down to making the point that this gold was worth $1,600 an ounce, and the amount of currency they had in circulation was about 100 times that. But some of the people that support Ron Paul, he's been pressing the issue, and he's got legitimate points, but auditing accomplishes absolutely nothing. I mean, the Fed keeps books, and they, you know, they get their numbers straight, and they dot the I's and all cross the T's and everything else. So I didn't expect the audit to produce any result. But one of the amusing results was that in assaying the gold, or assaying, I'm not sure what the term is, assaying, they discovered that some of it was a little bit more pure, and they actually had 27 troy ounces of gold more than they had calculated.
We have to end it right there because we're out of time.
The assay used 10 ounces. So as a consequence of the assay, we lost 10 ounces of gold from the Fed.
Well, let's pick it up next time. Let's talk also about the concept of auditing because I think it's a good topic too. Meanwhile, Bill, as usual, it's been a pleasure.
Yep.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.